Welcome back. This is the 20 Minute VC with me, Harry Stebbings, and my word, what a show we have in store for you today. Just this Tuesday, this company went public through a SPAC, something we go in detail about in this episode. They are one of the fastest companies to go from founding to $1 billion, and they're also one of the fastest companies to go from founding to IPO. And so with that, I'm thrilled to welcome Andrew Dudham, founder and CEO at Hims & Hers, offering a modern approach to health and wellness. Prior to their going public on Tuesday this week, Hims raised over $158 million from some of the best, including Thrive, Forerunner, Founders Fund, IVP, Redpoint, and more. As for Andrew, alongside his role at Hims, he's also co-founder of Atomic, a company builder and venture fund all in one, backed by the likes of Peter Thiel and Marc Andreessen. Prior to Atomic, Andrew led product at Talkbox, managing a team of 30 leading up to their acquisition by Telefonica in 2012. And I'd also want to say a huge thank you. This schedule was a real team effort, so huge thanks to Alex Bard, Jules Moltz, and Jack Abraham for some fantastic question suggestions today. Really am grateful for that. But before we dive into the show today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20 VC listeners get 10% off at SecureFrame.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. That's quite enough from me though, so now I'm very, very excited to hand over to newly public CEO Andrew Dudham, founder and CEO at Hims & Hers.
3, 2, 1, 0. You have now arrived at your destination.
Andrew, my friend, this is such a joy to do. From dinner in London to now recording this show and with the going public next week. I mean, my word, such exciting times. But thank you so much for joining me again today.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, listen, I've got a coffee in hand, so I've got far too much energy for this. But for those that missed our first episode, tell me, how did you make your way into the world of startups? And then what was the founding moment for you with Hims?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been building companies for about 15 years now. I started when I was an undergrad at Wharton. I was a sophomore and decided to drop out and join an early Sequoia capital company. I was spending way too much time hanging out outside the engineering school trying to convince people to build companies with me as opposed to showing up to my corporate finance classes. You know, had the lucky chance of helping run that company, sell that company to Telefonica in Spain in 2012, and then in the last 8-9 years, I've co-founded and ran a venture studio in San Francisco called Atomic Labs, which has allowed us to incubate and build companies and partner with people like Peter Thiel and Marc Andreessen and just get better at that entrepreneurial process. So, you know, I've been building for a long time, and it was a couple years ago that I really fell in love with the healthcare space, fell in love with the opportunity to help a lot of people, but also to digitize, I think, probably the last multi-trillion dollar industry in the US that really hasn't been touched by technology. It's like the same industry that was built 50 or 60 years ago, and being able to bring modern day consumer experiences, modern day technology to that and make everyone's life better, easier, more affordable, and more transparent when it comes to their healthcare was just a really exciting opportunity. So that's why I decided to jump ship and go and found Hims & Hers.
And I mean, my word, what a journey it's been, and what a fast journey it's been as well. I mean, it's almost as fast as a 20 minute VC episode. But I do want to dive into the show itself. And, you know, I spoke to a lot of mutual friends and investors beforehand, and they also all mentioned like the quality of the team. And when we chatted before, especially on team building, you said size matters and you need big teams. So talk to me about this and like, what have been your big lessons here?
I think each time you build a company, or at least my experience, each time I built a company, so many of the things I thought were right were completely wrong. And I think that's one in the last 4 and 5 years that has really changed my core belief, which is how big does a company need to be in order to scale to a certain size? And with Hims & Hers, we're going public in the next couple of days. By the time people are listening to this, we might actually already be public. And the company is about 100 people, 150 people. And that's incredibly small relative to traditional Silicon Valley. And so I think the lessons for me were around the benefits of autonomy for employees, the benefits of specialization instead of general employee talents. And then lastly, and this I think is maybe one of the most important parts, the importance of ego management. One of the things that I told to my managers from the very beginning was it is a requirement at Hims & Hers for every single person we hire for them to be better at the job we're hiring them for than we ourselves could do. And for people who have built large teams, that makes sense. You're a senior manager, you're confident in your role, you're used to hiring people that are smarter than you. For young managers, that's actually a really scary thing, right? Because they're trying to build these little fiefdoms where they've got 5-10 people and they all look up to you as a mentor and leader. And so for you to tell a young manager, hey, you're only going to succeed in this company if you go and convince somebody who's better than you and smarter than you and more specialized than you to work for you, it's kind of overwhelming and it kind of puts their ego in check. But what it's done for us is essentially kept the pipeline small, increased the quality of the average talent pool in the country as we've grown. So it's not diminishing, it's actually increasing in concentration. And I think has resulted in our ability to stay small with low bureaucracy, low brain damage dynamics, but move very, very quickly. And so I think that's how in 2.5-3 years, we're now in a position to be able to go and take the company public is because, you know, if you were to sample the average 5 people in the company, the IQ of the company is smarter today than it was 3-4 years ago.
Totally get you there in terms of that increasing IQ. I do have to ask, like, in terms of, like, you mentioned specialization there, we're all told that actually you need jack of all trades in the early days and then you move to specialists. Are you saying you don't agree with that then? Or if you do agree, when do you make the transition?
We made the transition fairly quickly. I think the moment that you have hit product market fit, which everyone can define differently, but the way I defined it was we weren't giving away the product. People were coming and taking out their credit card and willing to buy it with little to no pressure or effort. The moment you have that moment where people are willing to pay for your offering, that's where I believe the specialization is really beneficial because you're talking about experience, brand, engineering, customer service, supply chain, whatever it might be. And the generalization is really most impactful when you're trying to make all these pieces work together in order to prove to the customer that you have something worth buying. But once you've hit that point, and I think for us, we hit product market fit within the first month or so of launch. From that point on, we jumped very quickly to start working on specialization. And I think a lot of teams actually just wait too late to do that.
It was at that moment though that actually I spoke to Jules Maltz from IVP before the show. And he said an astounding element of Andrew is his ability to bring in truly world-class execs. And so for me, like when you think about like what you've done that allowed you to do that, what have been some big lessons for you in terms of what it takes to acquire the very, very best exec talent?
You know, it's an ongoing process to learn how to attract great talent. I think one of the things that I've found is people that have incredible careers of specialization and they've built businesses and are really experts at what they do, they always want to push and prove to themselves that they can take on more ownership. And so what we've made, I think is a very intentional opportunity at Hims & Hers, is the ability for those types of talent to come jump into shoes that are much bigger than they've ever jumped. And they have the track record, right? They've been specialists at what they've done for years, probably 10, 15 years. But now we're going to give them that and something more, right? And that's incredibly exciting to them because people who are type A and highly motivated to succeed always want to prove it to themselves that they can do so. And so we have an organization of people that are striving, like truly striving, and have been given space to strive and room to strive. And I think that's where you end up getting somebody who is an incredibly high talented person performing at their best is where you give them that dynamic. I think the other thing that's really important to people that are this A quality talent, this specialization veteran talent, you know, they want to work for something that has energy and passion and vision, right? So I spent a ton of time in the first few years and I spend a ton of time today actually still interviewing just about every major senior candidate that comes through the organization. And a big part of that is actually for them to hear from me why I'm so passionate about this company, right? For them to hear about the vision, for them to hear about the energy, for them to hear about why joining the business is going to be so exciting for them. And for people that have had careers of success, passion and energy and excitement matter more. They have flexibility to pick where they're going to go next. It's not just about money. It's not just about title. It's about life. And it's about kind of using maybe their last or their second to last gig as something that can be a real moment in their life that they're proud of. And so I think that vision and that founder story is an important sell when you're talking about that type of talent.
Totally. And they join you then, and they join you on the journey. And as we said, it's been just such a fast journey in terms of one of the fastest companies to reach $1 billion. And I spoke to Alex Bard, a mutual friend of ours, before the show, and he asked a really interesting one, which is like, obviously that's a period of hypergrowth, but like, on reflection, how do you think you managed the hypergrowth? What did you do well, and what would you do differently?
You know, I think we did a lot of things terribly, to be honest. Everything broke. The supply chain broke, the website broke, the analytics stack that we had built broke, our team wasn't prepared, we didn't have enough customer support agents. I mean, quite literally within the first 6 months, we had to rebuild the company after launch. But in retrospect, that preparedness wasn't necessary to prove the product market fit, right? That it just wasn't needed to do. And so what I think we did well was always focused on the customer and would then, behind the scenes, fix all of the things broken and speed it up so that the customer was essentially taken care of. But I think as we've grown, we've actually done what I think most companies, it gets harder to do. We've actually just focused more and more and more on the people coming through the experience. From day one, we had 200 people signing up. Now we have thousands of people signing up a day, but we're closer to those thousands of people than we were the 200. We understand them better. We understand their demographics. We understand why they struggle with the experience, why they leave, what they love. We have whole insights teams around that. And so I think if there's one thing we did well, it's build an organization that cares about the customer and is quantifying the customer success so that as we scale, we can manage that relationship better. Everything else we probably did pretty terribly.
Well, I love the honesty there. Can I ask, in terms of like the first things to break, just for founders who are kind of looking ahead and projecting their minds ahead of what could go wrong, for you, what were the first signs of breakage?
Well, quite literally, we couldn't ship packages. The first signs of breakage were really phone calls at 6 a.m. on the day of launch from my co-founder saying the team we had signed up for the last 6 months for our supply chain is saying that they don't think they have the volume to ship the packages on this day, the first day of launch. Or it means on the third day of launch, the site literally not taking checkouts. So we were spending all this money on marketing. People were coming to the site. They were putting the things in their cart. They were going through their medical visits. They were clicking submit to checkout and the button wasn't working, right? It like quite literally wasn't working. And the only way you caught it was because a few hours into the day, you're looking at the graph and you're like, huh, as of 11 a.m., we've had nobody sign up. It's just been completely flat at, you know, 122 visits for 4 hours. Something must be wrong. So, you know, I think for us, it wasn't magic to find what broke. It just broke right in front of us and it broke beautifully and dramatically. And I actually think, to be honest, for most companies, when things break, that's how it breaks. You just see it, you fix it fast, and then you try your best to figure out what systems you can put in place so that the stupid stuff that breaks, breaks a little bit less often.
Can I ask personally, like, I'm sometimes good, sometimes terrible in crisis environments. How do you deal with the shit hit the fan moments when you're like, shit, people can't check out?
I think I'm actually relatively strong in that. And maybe my team, you could do like some background interviews with my team. Maybe they'll tell me I'm terrible at it. But I think one of the things I realized was when you're in those environments, everybody is scared. Everybody is scared for themselves because they don't know if they were directly responsible. They're scared for the business. They're upset that it happened. They feel guilty that it happened. And so the reality is applying pressure, human pressure, anger, or emotional dynamics to that environment does not in any way accelerate your ability to fix it quickly, which in that moment is actually all that matters. It doesn't matter for you to say, okay, well, let's figure out some retrospectives here and figure out how this happened to make sure it doesn't happen again. In that day or in that hour or in that week, all that matters is that people are focused, they're energized, and they feel like they're empowered to fix it because you need to get it fixed as quickly as possible. And there's been dozens of times in the Hims and Hers life where you couldn't buy something on the website or the website was down or there were no doctors in California available. These things happen. And so in all of those moments, it's a put your head down, let's get it done. And then once it's done and it's stable, let's all get together and figure out how it happened and how we can make sure it doesn't happen again. And so I think just the awareness of the dynamics that can improve that situation versus actually detract from the success of that situation has helped me adjust how I react to it. And in a lot of ways has frankly just removed the emotional dynamic that I think is so instinctive to people.
I do want to kind of move more towards the present day though. And obviously with the incredibly exciting element of kind of the going public very, very soon. The first question is like, you're one of the fastest from founding to IPO. Why did you decide now was the right time to do it?
I think from the beginning of launching this business, as we were talking about product market fit, we saw that we had unlocked a tremendous amount of passion from people, right? We were seeing hundreds of orders a day. Within the first year, we were doing $5-10 million in revenue. With now just 3 years in, we're approaching $150 million in revenue roughly, right? So we knew quickly that there was demand and that we had to start getting ready for building a big company. I think when it comes to being a public company, it was a little bit more of an emotional and instinctive decision, which is that for myself as a public market investor, I don't see opportunities like Hims and Hers in the public market. And I want to invest in companies like Hims and Hers in the public market. And what I mean by that is a company that's growing incredibly fast, right? We were growing 90%, 100% year-over-year revenue growth, where their efficiency is actually improving year-over-year, right? We're not just lighting money on fire like most companies, but we're actually burning less. Our efficiency is improving. Our margins are 76%, right? It's like, it's a good business and it's an improving business. The trends are all going in the right direction. But even more so, you have that revenue and efficiency combo in an industry like healthcare that is literally in the first inning of a 15-inning baseball game. It's like this massive multi-trillion-dollar industry that for all types of reasons is just on the precipice of being completely revolutionized. So for the next 5, 10, 15 years, you've got this incredible robust growth. Name me a company in the public markets that sounds like that and I'll go put most of my money into it, but I just can't find it. And I think in reality, the last 10 years in the Valley, companies have felt like it was smarter and better to build in the private markets. It was easier. It was faster to raise capital. They didn't have to worry about the rigor of the public dynamics. And I think as a result, the public markets have really craved growth, efficiency, innovation, and it's just not there, which is why you see all of the money going towards Facebook, Amazon, Tesla, Google, right? Just like five companies. There's just not a lot of options in the public markets for people that are looking for amazing growth opportunities. And so to me, as a public market investor, I think it's a rare story to see. And I think it's a story that really needs to be told. And I think it's a story that will really excite people. And I think it's a really massive advantage for us as a business to be able to figure out how to balance that incredible robust growth with that efficiency and structure that the public markets require and have that built into our DNA. I mean, I think a lot of people forget that some of the biggest companies in the world were created and founded and then IPO'd within a few years, right? Like Google was, I think, like 5 or 6 years. Amazon was 4 years, 3 years. Apple was 3 or 4 years. These companies did not stay private for 10, 15, 20 years, right? They built, they succeeded, they launched in the public markets, and then they learned how to grow efficiently, how to tell their story, and they had that into their DNA, which I think has actually been a core part of how they've been able to continue to succeed.
Well, I mean, we're going to get to building in public and kind of the benefits and maybe drawbacks. So I do want to just in terms of like the process of getting that, I'm super interested because obviously there's the usual IPO process and there's also the SPAC today. And tell me, how did the SPAC process play out and what did that look like? Just help me understand it.
The board at Hims and Hers and the founders were all fairly traditional venture capitalists, right? In Silicon Valley, venture capitalists and entrepreneurs from the Valley, we know the traditional IPO process. Like it's a fairly blue chip team, maybe so to speak. And so the majority of the board, including myself, had never heard of a SPAC. We had never known about those structures and modalities. We had been expecting and preparing in the last 18 months to take the company public through a traditional IPO process. I think what happened was in the beginning of 2020, we sat down with advisors and we understood the dynamics of what was happening and learned about the dynamics. And DraftKings was actually one of the first companies to decide to go public via a SPAC and dove into why they did that. And some of the things you learn are it's a process that allows for greater efficiency, right? A process that can take 6 months versus maybe 12 or 18 months. And when you're talking about management distraction and you're talking about people actually focused on your business versus focus outside your business, the SPAC has real advantages. You're talking about a process that allows you to get great long-term public market investors to help you price the deal at the very beginning, right? So you know, okay, this is the deal price. This is what we think the public market's going to value us at. And public investors are going to stand by that price from the beginning. You think of traditional IPOs, they have a roadshow, and then pretty much on the last day of the process of 1 year out, 18 months out, they're pricing the deal, they're dropping the price or increasing the price. You have no idea what the company's going to trade for. It then pops 100% the next day, which while that looks great, is actually a huge amount of cost to the entrepreneur and to the team, right? It just means that they priced the deal wrong. In a SPAC world, I think there's far less risk of that. You're pricing it on the front end with real public market investors. And so when we just looked under the hood of this traditional IPO process, which really hasn't changed, right, in a decade or two, right? It's the same process with little iterations. And then you look at this new modality of a SPAC transaction, it just had advantages, efficiency dynamics, affordability dynamics, speed dynamics. And ultimately, we found that it was worth it. It just made a lot more sense. From a first principle standpoint, if you're looking at the two structures, structures as ways to go public, the SPAC made more sense. And so I fully expect in the next 5-10 years, more founders to consider that route, because it was not something that I had heard of and not something my board had heard of, but we just looked at it from the ground up and dissected it and ended up feeling really good about it.
Can I ask, you mentioned the pop there, and it always looks good and it sounds fantastic when you hear it. With more efficient pricing though, you have less hype because you don't have the pop. Do you worry about not having the pop and not having the hims and hers trading at 100% on first day? Is that a concern?
It's a great question. The pop creates energy and an excitement. It's a very expensive moment of energy. And for people that don't understand this dynamic, I think the fact that a company is doubling in value the first day means that the company was taking money as part of the IPO at the wrong price, at a price that was probably 50% what they should have been doing. And so there's a huge amount of dilution that they incurred as part of the IPO that they probably shouldn't have incurred. And so it's very, very costly. Yes, it gets buzz, right? You can get that CNBC clip, you can get Cramer talking about it for the day, whatever it might be. Do I think it massively influences the success of the company? Not at all, right? I don't think there's any correlation between that first day pop and long-term success of the business. That comes down to execution and consistent storytelling and consistent improvements in the business and expansion in the business. And so I think my general belief with Hims and Hers is that it's a business that will thrive in the public markets regardless of the hype around it. It is a great business. And all you have to do is look at the business to understand that. And if that takes an extra couple of months or an extra couple of years for investors to wrap their heads around, that's okay. That's fine to me because I'm 32. Our team sees this as a vision that in 10, 20 years, we're going to continue to be working on. And I think the opportunity, you know, really requires us to put that amount of time into it. And so when you have that type of horizon, and I think that degree of confidence in the fundamentals of the company makes you kind of give a little less shit about the first day pop. And I think that's kind of the reality of where we're at.
Can I ask, you mentioned the increasing inefficiencies in the business getting kind of more efficient in terms of capital allocation and then also margins improving. In a world where Wall Street seems to favor growth above all else, how do you think about kind of the lever of growth versus profitability? And what's your thoughts on that, given Wall Street's perception on growth today being so primary?
You know, Wall Street's perception on growth versus efficiency changes by the day. This is the reality. You know, we've got 7 banks signed up for this IPO. I get emails from them every morning about them interpreting the day's market. And they all kind of sound something like, today people favored value versus growth because of the inauguration. Or yesterday they favored growth instead of value because people feel good about stimulus checks. I mean, it literally changes every day. And so the reality is you just need to build a nice blend of both. You cannot grow endlessly and burn money at an increasing pace. It's not a good business. The trends don't work, right? If you project that out, it doesn't make any sense. You also can't have margins continuing to expand and growth dramatically decreasing. That also isn't going to work, right? So I think for us, we're lucky in that we have a business that has inherently very robust margins, right? You're selling pharmaceuticals, which have very good cost basis. You're selling subscriptions to everybody. 90% of business is recurring revenue. And it's, as we know, medications that once you start, you generally take for the remainders of your life. So very long lifetime values, very long retention dynamics. So we have core fundamentals that allow us to have healthy, robust margins. And I think for us, it's just always going to be a balance. And that's a conversation that I have with my CFO and my team, probably on a weekly basis, is how and when we want to push one or more of the levers to meet what we think is the perfect medium.
You mentioned the speed and the efficiency of the SPAC. And I do want to talk about time itself, because we've touched on it before. And my question to you is, like, how do you think about leveraging your time to unlock real power? And how should we and how should I be thinking about it, Andrew?
There are units of time that I think unintentionally slow us down. And what I mean by that is, yeah, let's get that on the calendar. We should have a meeting. You know, I'll schedule it for next week, right? Or things are really busy. Let's talk next quarter. Next quarter's months away. Or I'm totally swamped on Tuesday. How's next Friday? You know, you think in days or you think in quarters. And I think as we've grown as a company, the more I'm hearing people talk about quarters in the second half of the year versus the first half of the year. And I think those units of measurement unknowingly actually really hurt us, right? Because it allows and facilitates the ability for us to go slow. And so what I try to do with our team and what I try to do with myself is break things down into the smallest unit of time and understand what the actual amount of time is necessary to accomplish that goal. And so what I often do is say, okay, what are we doing before breakfast? What are we doing between breakfast and lunch? What's happening right after lunch? Between lunch and the time all the engineers leave to go get their 2 p.m. coffee, what are we doing post-caffeination at 2:30 until 5 when people are starting to get distracted by their kids? And you start to think in those types of units, and all of a sudden you're accomplishing 4 times what you thought was possible in one day just by changing your mentality and approach to units. And so I think that there's a huge amount of leverage in time that people are just unknowingly losing by essentially using the wrong words. And so I try really hard to really be tough on my team and say, we don't need to talk about that next week. That's something that's a 15-minute conversation. Is everyone free right now? Right? I mean, we're all slacking. Everyone's in the channel talking about how we're scheduling. So we're clearly not in meetings. Are people free right now for a quick 10-minute conversation? Everyone's free. Great. Let's do it. Done. Right. And you did it today instead of 2 weeks from now. And so I just encourage people to do that as much as we can. And so I think people have learned when they tell me, cool, we'll schedule this for a few weeks out or next quarter, that I'm going to have an emotional response of like, well, why not tomorrow or why not next week? I'm free. I can do it. Can you guys do it? And so I think there's huge amounts of time built in there that just is getting lost.
So if we change our mentality around time, another big thing to think about mentalities around is actually money. And it's something that we never talk about in this industry, which I find so funny, given, you know, I'm a venture capitalist, you in ways are a venture capitalist with Atomic. Like with liquidity and with IPOs does come, you know, obviously more personal wealth. I'm intrigued. How do you think about your relationship to money and how has that changed over time, do you think?
I think in the beginning years of my career, when I was right out of school and I got my first product manager job and I was making $50,000, and that was just, I was so excited. I didn't think I would ever be able to make $50,000 a year doing what I loved, which was designing things and building things. I didn't even know it was a job. Mickey O'Brien, who's currently the CEO of Bonobos over at Walmart, she was the first person that hired me out of school. And she sat me down and said, you know, the thing you love doing, which is designing and building products, it's a job. You can be a product manager. And that was probably the most like valuable thing I'd ever heard in my life, because I realized I could get paid for doing what I love to do. But at that point, it was all about necessity. It was, you know, how do I get to a point where I can make 100K? Because at 100K, I could live comfortably. I could have an apartment in San Francisco. I could save some money in this expensive city. And it was necessity, necessity, necessity. And there was fear of not being able to hit that milestone, right? And not being able to have the ability in my life to have kids and buy a house and get married. And I'm like kind of an old soul. So like those were quite literally the things I was worried about in my early 20s. At this point, money still scares me, to be honest, but it's for very, very different reasons. It's because I think money at this point, and when you're talking about an IPO, it is maybe one of the biggest risks to changing the things you love in your life, right? Your relationship with your spouse, your relationship with your family, your friends, how you spend your time, who you surround yourself with, the honest feedback you get from people, right, in your groups, how they react to you, what they say to you. I mean, all of those things are at risk because of money. And there's plenty of stories and data points to show that. And so money still really scares me, I think, just for very, very different reasons. And it scares me so much that, to be completely honest, Leia and I, you know, my wife, we talk a lot about how we're going to give it away as quickly as possible. We think about money as, let's get that pool of money that gives us peace of mind to live our life and be happy and not screw up our kids and not screw up any of the family dynamics, any of the relation dynamics we want to maintain. And then after that point, how do we give it away? And how do we help other people? And so I think you'll see us give most of that money away in the next 10, 20, 30 years. Not only is it because we want to help as many people as we can, but it's because we want to preserve the things that we value in our life, I think, today.
I mean, speaking of giving it away, and final one before the quick fire, it's not giving it away, but kids do take a lot of money, as my father always tells me. But I do have to ask, like, you're about to become a father for the first time. Insanely exciting. How do you think becoming a father will change maybe your mindset around leadership, around engagement with the team, around being an operator? How do you think it changes?
I think the biggest thing that pops up for me is how my son is going to react to how I lead. The things I say, the way I lead, the types of reactions I have to people, the amount of empathy I use with people, the patience I maintain with my team, you know, things that I can always improve on without question. And you can ask anybody that's worked for me, there's 100 things that I need to improve on. You know, I think there's just more of an emotional dynamic that I think about when having a kid, because that kid's going to be sitting there watching me do it, right? They're going to be in the room, right, working from home in these dynamics. They're going to watch me when I get upset. They're going to watch me when I'm wrong. They're going to watch me how I react when somebody did something amazing. How did I respond to that person? How was I appreciative of that person? And so I think there's an emotional dynamic for me of just kind of a reflection of my leadership style, because I want to be obviously a leader that my kids can look at and be proud proud of. And I think that's something that you're not always proud of when you're in a high grind, high intensity situation. You lose your temper, or you're not thinking smart, or you're not taking the time to be patient, whatever it is, right? So I think that's something that I think hopefully will just continue to improve. And I think, you know, a little kid will probably accelerate that.
Listen, I'm so excited. I cannot wait to see the baby pictures. Mm-hmm. And come as I think 18 years before mojitos can actually happen with Andrew Dunham Jr. But I'm excited for that. I'll probably be about 28 by then. but I want to move into a quick fire now, Andrew. So I say a short statement and you hit me with your immediate thoughts. Are you ready to rock and roll?
Let's do it.
So what's the favorite book and why?
My most recent favorite book is a book called The Planet Remade. It's by Oliver Morton. And this book is about essentially geoengineering and how geoengineering and essentially earth hacking could really change the world and particularly counterbalance a lot of the effects of climate change.
How did you get Snoop Dogg involved so early on?
Ron Conway introduced me to Snoop. We smoked weed, ate Popeyes, and ate our vitamin gummies. And he loved the vitamin gummies and decided to get signed up.
I wasn't expecting that, but I love that as a story. What's the hardest element of your role with Hims today?
The hardest thing to balance with Hims right now is constantly wanting to invest in the business and also knowing that this is a marathon and balancing that time of rest and time with family while also knowing that there's this huge opportunity that you want to run at every single second.
Okay, this is a really hard one. What three traits would you most want your children to adopt?
The one trait, and maybe I'll say it three times, is I want my kid to be kind. Kind, kind, kind. I think more than anything else.
Which leader do you most look up to and why?
You know, I look up to Bill Gates and Melinda quite a bit. I think what they've done in the post-Microsoft years, the continued investment in technology, the continued push on health, the continued focus on populations that need focus more than any populations is just incredibly powerful and is just an incredible mentor for me and the people around me.
How did you get A-Rod and J-Lo and how is it working with them?
Jennifer and Alex are incredible. We had an amazing first couple of times together having dinner at their home. Talked about the vision for Hims and Hers. The thing that really got Jennifer and Alex excited was how do you get access to amazing healthcare products to people that really need them in underserved populations? Both of them come from very little and they've proven and they've succeeded and they've gone with grit to achieve what they have, but they are also very close to the realities of what they grew up with and the people in their communities. And so being able to build Hims and Hers as a business that could provide access to healthcare products and medicine and physicians for really affordable prices to everybody, and they could go tell their communities that the best quality medicine that they get, you can now get too. That was really what got Jennifer and Alex so excited, and it's been wonderful to work with them.
Now, super tough one here. The best board member that you've worked with and why?
I think my favorite board member that I had the privilege of being on a lot of boards with is my co-founder at Atomic, which is Jack Abraham. And that is because Jack refuses to think in a linear fashion. His brain is just incapable of thinking in the straightforward linear way that I think most of our brains function. And so I have always been constantly at awe at how he interprets three or four pieces of data entirely different than a room full of the smartest VCs. And I think that is a skill and is a component of a boardroom that I, you know, really, really value. And I've had a lot of fun working with him because of that.
I think the world of Jack, real man crush from me with Jack. Yeah, total hero. But final one, Andrew, tell me, paint the vision, paint the picture. What do the next 5 years hold for you and for Hims and Hers?
You know, I think for me in the business, I'm going to continue to run this business because I'm incredibly passionate about where we're at. I think we're in the first couple of innings of what I was saying is a very, very long baseball game. I don't know if they have baseball out where you're from, but this opportunity to transform healthcare, to give people access to healthcare from the comfort of their phone, they can go to a website, forhims.com, they can pick it up and immediately get connected to a doctor for $20. I mean, it's something that I think hundreds of millions of people in this country would benefit from. It's something we're incredibly passionate to stay focused on. So I think 5 years from now, hopefully we're a much larger part of people's lives. We're helping more people. We're in part of more conditions and more countries, and we're continuing to do what we love doing.
I mean, it's been such an incredible journey, and I can't thank you enough for doing this, Andrew. Some very exciting times ahead.
Thank you, Harry, for having me.
I have to say, I just love Andrew. And if you didn't know that, hearing that, Andrew's been an incredible friend, supporter, and advisor to me. So much love for him, and just so excited for the journey ahead with Hims as a public company. If you'd like to see more from us behind the scenes at the show, you can on Instagram at hstebbings1996 with two Bs. I always love to see you there. But before we leave you today, did you know that more than 80% of US public stock is owned by just 10% of Americans? This divide is even greater in the private markets. Carta makes it as easy to issue equity to your employees as it is to issue payroll, and for employees, as easy to accept it too. More than 16,000 companies issue equity to their employees through Carta. Whether you're just getting started or getting ready to go public, the team at Carta can help. Check them out at carta.com. And then another incredible product you have to introduce is SecureFrame. SecureFrame helps companies get enterprise ready by streamlining SOC 2 and ISO 27001 compliance. SecureFrame allows companies to get compliant within weeks rather than the painful months that it is today. Join companies like Stream, Hasura, Benepass, and unlock more sales with SecureFrame. And 20VC listeners get 10% off at secureframe.com/20VC. And finally, I've always been a big history fan, and so I want to talk about Cooley, the global law firm built around startups and venture capital. Since forming the very first venture fund in Silicon Valley, Cooley's formed more venture capital funds than any other law firm in the world, with 50 plus years working with VCs. They help VCs form and manage funds, make investments, and handle the myriad of issues that arise throughout a fund's lifetime. So to learn more about the number one most active law firm representing VC-backed companies going public, head over to Cooley.com and also check out CooleyGo.com. As always, I so appreciate all your support, and I can't wait to bring you an incredible episode on Monday with Ilka, founder and CEO at Supercell.